Hey ADHD mums, I've got something that might save you from that 2 a.m. Google rabbit hole where ADHD somehow leads you to diagnosing yourself with 14 unrelated conditions and then you freak out at 2 a.m. This takes all the guesswork out of it. It is called the ADHD Pre-Diagnosis Workbook, a guide for women and mothers. Think of this as your ADHD assessment survival kit. Part cheat sheet, part pep talk, and completely designed to help you from second guessing whether it's ADHD or just mum life. Here's what's inside. Prompts to help you organize your thoughts, because let's be real, those shower epiphanies, they are gone by the time you tail off. Tips for talking to psychiatrists, because nothing screams classic ADHD like knowing that you've researched the condition to death, but still feeling the urge to act surprised when they diagnose you. And let's face it, there's always that moment of, do I sound too confident? Do they think I'm just getting meds? Should I sound like I don't know? Should I sound like I do know? What if they don't even diagnose me at the end of this? This workbook is everything I wish I'd known before my diagnosis. It creates templates. All you've got to do is just plug it in. So you're not walking in late to your appointment, babbling about a year's worth of random thoughts that somehow never make it to paper. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au. And all of the links will be in the show notes. So let's go into today's episode, because if you're anything like me, you've already started multitasking and you probably don't even remember what this episode is called. Hello and welcome back to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have a great episode on the ADF and ADHD. Big episode I've wanted to do for a long time. A lot of people don't realize that I'm ex-ADF or I'm ex-RAF. And I've brought in Jess, who is ex-Army. So Jess is here to discuss ADF and ADHD and the different ways that that can really impact. Would you like to give just a brief overview about who you are, where you live, Jess?
So I'm from Townsville up in Northern Queensland. I have one son called Archer, married to a very patient husband. I've been discharged from the ADF for coming up to 3 years now. It's been a massive transition. So I make tapes and I'm always busy and I find that I take on way too much, but that's just me learning how to adjust to not being in that defense force.
Yeah, absolutely. It's tricky, isn't it? Because yeah, there's that real identity shift that happens that I think is hard to understand if you haven't been in it.
Yeah, well, 21 years, it was my life. So learning to be a civilian has been very interesting.
Yes, yes. And you left the ADF because?
Yep, I was actually medically discharged because I was unable to rehabilitate from a lot of injuries that I'd sustained both within Australia and during my 6 deployments over to the Middle East, East Timor and Dubai. The jobs that I did were very, very labour intensive. And I didn't realise it as well. I was suffering from depression, PTSD and anxiety. And it all culminated when I couldn't perform my physical training to the level that I did, which I now know was how I got my dopamine fixes. And one day I actually fell over. I was going to commit suicide and I basically walked out of work and never went back.
Wow. Okay. Do you mind me asking? Had you had suicidal thoughts and you escalated that quickly, or how did that go?
So I had a real nasty voice in my head for quite a while and it got worse after my last deployment. My last deployment was quite stressful for me because I was actually the postmaster for the whole Middle Eastern region and I left my son, who was only 2 at the time. I was already emotionally a bit strung out because it's different when you don't have children deploying overseas. And I'd deployed 5 times before, but leaving my son had already started what I believe is a roller coaster plus toxic chain of command, people not understanding. And that was, I think, the beginning of the snowball effect to me, my mental health going downhill. I was driving home one day and the voices were really, really bad. And I was basically going to drive my car into a light pole, but my husband rang up and said, oh, hey, are you going to pick up the little fella? And I went, oh, shit. Went home, told him what had occurred, and basically marched into the ROP the next morning, and that was it, I was done. I got to the stage at work where I didn't want to go in the morning. I was feeling physically sick. I'd lost a hell of a lot of weight. I remember one of the warrant officers I was quite good friends with came in one day and he shut the door and I just started crying. So it was, yeah. And the last poaching I had, the major was quite toxic as well. So it was a lot to take.
Well, I think it's great that you connected with your husband and asked for help when you needed it. Well done, because there's a lot of people that don't do that and it's really unspoken about.
Yeah, well, my husband actually, before he met me, he actually suffered from depression. And so he's actually quite open to it all. And his mum has worked in disability services for like 50 years. So she's educated both my boys. And she's made an amazing part of my recovery as well, because when I did fall over, she actually just came and sat beside me, patted my hand and let me cry and got me cups of tea. And she's always just been that wonderful constant support. And that was like when they did send the AMCs away from my son, I knew that Nan was there.
Yeah, and you know that social support piece can't be undervalued in someone's recovery across any mental health situation. So credit to your family as well for jumping in behind you.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
So if we go back to ADHD, you were a girl who was diagnosed with ADHD at 4, which is so rare. How did that shape your childhood, especially being the only neurodivergent child in your family?
So I think people were a bit more patient knowing that I was so full on, but I was a happy little kid who just had so much energy. I'd run rings around my sisters and my brothers, and I was never malicious or angry or anything like that. I just was always on the go, always asking questions, wouldn't sleep. I mean, some of the things I did when I was a kid, I still remember, like breaking into the house after my sisters had gone to sleep and go down the swimming pool for a swim. And they could never figure out how I did it, because I was crafty and I would put my brother's solitaire back, unstack his books, because that's how I'd get out. And then I'd take off. And
wow.
Yeah.
So did you try medication back then or?
So my mum, the doctor, he gave her Ritalin and she tried me on it, but she couldn't handle the fact that one minute I was running around happy doing my thing and the next minute I was passed out on the floor asleep. So I think titration and that back then just wasn't existent. And my mum couldn't handle it. And she was just like, no, I'm not medicating you, no way.
Yeah, it's tough when I think now it's so progressive. There's so many different options. And sometimes I think people don't realise that. So when they get that initial Ritalin script, which seems to be, a few doctors have told me it's Medicare legislation to start every child and person on Ritalin. But if you don't know there's anything else, or there isn't anything else, which probably was the case back then, and it doesn't work, then, you know, there's not that backup opportunity to go and try anything else.
Yeah, well, now Psych has actually re-diagnosed me and we started on Vyvanse, but we figured that my metabolism is so fast, it's not lasting the 14 hours. It's only lasting maybe 6. So in the afternoon, I was having these awful crashes. And by listening to people on your podcast and that, I figured it out. And I said to him, I think this is not working. And he's put me on a top up, which is fine now.
Yeah, I love a good top up too. So for reference of anyone who's listening, if you take a long-acting stimulant, for example, Vyvanse, Concerta's long-acting Ritalin and Vyvanse is long-acting dexamphetamine, that's a very simplified version of it, right? There's a few little ingredient changes between Vyvanse and dexamphetamine. But if you're a fast metabolizer like Jess, your Vyvanse, it should last between 8 to 12 hours, can crash you out at, you know, 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, right on pickup. And so then at that point, a lot of women and men, kids, have a dexamphetamine top up. So same for the Concerta. If you're taking Concerta and then you get the crash, you can look at a Ritalin top up. But yeah, it's a really great point. And the other side to it as well is if you don't eat or drink because you're not feeling hungry or thirsty, I would have this huge hunger, like headache, all these effects. I realized I hadn't eaten or drunk all day. Okay, you have had such a diverse career path. You know, I know that you became a chef, you served in the army for 21 years. How did having ADHD influence your career highs and challenges that you faced?
Well, the good thing about ADHD is we have so much energy. So with defense, that is such a big thing, because your PT, when you go field, you've got energy to burn, whereas everyone else is like falling asleep. We're very good at changing from one thing to another very, very rapidly, which is with defense, unfortunately, they're not super proactive. It's normally reactive. And when I became an operations sergeant, it was really good for me because I could flip from one thing to another. And I'm an outgoing personality, so I know a lot of people, not just within my corps. I would know all the other logistics. I'd know infantry, and I'd be like, well, I'm not sure how to do that. Hey, how do we do this? How do we do that? And just being that full-on chatterbox, everyone remembers you. So it really helped with networking and being able to really combine the different areas to make sure that we got the outcome that we needed for the task we were given, as you would be well aware of.
Oh, look, in some ways, I found ADHD to be quite difficult. Obviously, everyone presents differently, and I agree with a lot of what you said. Absolutely, yes. The drawback I had with it, amongst many, was that I don't have a very high attention to detail. So for me, close enough is good enough. I'm an 80%er. I lose interest in the last 20% of anything that I do. And so when you have to have everything so intensely done correctly the whole way through every time, I found it incredibly challenging. Do you know what I mean? Or is that different for you?
Yeah. So I think I was a bit of a perfectionist. And now that I would have a lot of meltdowns when I got home because things just didn't happen my way. But I guess I taught myself to just go, well, sir, you got to just, like, the job's been done. No one's been injured. Let's be happy with that. So I learned to sort of lower my standards. But I always suffered from really bad imposter syndrome. And when I first joined, it was really difficult to concentrate, especially when we were first initially learning weapons drills and all that sort of thing. I'd be constantly going to the boat and saying, what did he say? So I would have just gone, can't zone out or be too busy talking to someone. But that constant learning everything over and over and over again was amazing for me because you got that muscle memory. And then there's still to this day are things within the military that I don't have any idea about. Like, I would always get confused when we were doing our orders and that, and one up and two up. And I was always in trouble with this in my mouth.
Oh, for talking too much?
I would engage with my mouth before my brain, and it would be someone with a higher rank, and I'd be in the shit.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, like, inappropriate, like not responding to hierarchy. Yes. Yes. I used to impulsively ask questions, but they were like really dumb ones that you probably should just ask the person next to you. And I would not realize what was a stupid question and what was a relevant question that you should ask. So when they would say, any questions, I would just ask all of my questions and I would have seven, right? And I didn't realize actually in that environment, you are supposed to just nod and smile, do not ask any questions, pretend like you know what you're doing, and then ask the person next to you. Like, oh, I must be the only person that doesn't understand. And I would ask all the questions and then they would go, what the fuck? You don't know anything, and start giving it to me. And I'd be thinking, I swear no one else knows this either.
But they would also go, no questions, dumb question. Just ask the question. But all your peers would be sitting there going, shut up.
Yeah. But because I'm literal, I'm like, they go, no questions are dumb questions. So I just think, well, I'll ask all my questions.
When I first joined, peer pressure was a lot different to what it is now. There could be contact cancelling out the back with the seniors. Things were a lot more physical when I first joined.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, it would be. I doubt I would have survived, to be honest. So being re-diagnosed as an adult must have been really eye-opening for you. How has it helped you both as an individual and a parent to a child with ADHD?
Well, it's helped me to understand when he has his meltdowns, because I'm like, oh yeah, dude. I understand. Like, he is such a perfectionist and he will hyper focus on something. And if it is not perfect, bang. But I now know I need to stay calm, because before I was like, and I'd lose my temper. So it's teaching me to calm down and just let him ride it out, give him cuddles and all that sort of thing. Explain to him things aren't always going to be perfect. And you're more like your mother than you know, but you're more like your dad too. So, yeah, it has been a learning curve. And as I said, my psychiatrist and psychologist have been great helping to sort of reprogram me or reteach me how to do this, because as a little boy changes, it's all a learning curve for me.
Oh, absolutely, definitely. If you were to look back on your journey, what would you tell other parents navigating ADHD, whether it's their own or their child's?
Oh, educate yourself as much as you can. Find your friends. You know, the research is now coming out that neurodiversity within the population could be as high as 50%. Educate yourself, read everything, talk to the experts and just try and have a bit of patience with your children. Yes, they still need their boundaries. There is no excuse for bad behaviour, but you have to be a bit patient, especially when they have these meltdowns. They need your love, your cuddles, you know, taking them somewhere quiet and just letting them know there for them. But as I said, you know, you've got to know the difference between a meltdown and bad behaviour as well, which can be quite difficult at times.
And for you, you know, just my take on your journey, I think you've done really well about asking for help. I think, you know, you've sought help in a crisis with your family. Then you've gone to reach out to professionals, which you've been really proactive in seeing, and then with your son as well. How do you think that has made an impact for you?
Oh, I think hitting that rock bottom and putting my hand out for help was the best thing I ever do. Asking for that help can be tougher than what you've gone through before. Anyone I see who's having issues, I always say to them, no one is going to judge you. You need to look after yourself so you're here for not only yourself, but for the people who love you, you know? Yeah.
Because it would be easier in some ways. You know, this may not be the same for you, but this is the same with a lot of women I talk to. It's almost easier to just go back to hyperactive productivity, to just keeping working and putting your head down and go bum up in a different job, in a different organisation. But actually facing the issues that will keep chasing you is an incredibly brave thing to do.
Mm. Yeah, you've got to put the hard work in. I mean, when I was diagnosed with PTSD, I was luckily enough to be led to a absolutely brilliant female psychologist who specialised in EMDR, and it was the best thing I've ever did. It just totally reframed that whole trauma that I was living over and over again. And I now look at that from a more, I guess, outside of it place instead of being in there. Yeah. And now, and my next challenge is getting my ADHD under control.
Yeah. And look, for anyone who doesn't know, EMDR is a really relevant form of therapy. I actually really recommend it to a lot of people. I'm just going to do a quick overview because people are going to want to know.
Yeah.
What Jess is talking about is EMDR therapy. It is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a psychotherapy and usually done by psychologists and clinical psychologists that enable people to heal from the symptoms and emotional distress that they have as a result of disturbing life experiences. I do tell people that EMDR therapy is psychological surgery. That's what I call it because it is intense, it's upfront, and you just go right there to the moment. It's not for everybody, so you need to be aware of what it is before you start. And I reckon it takes a year, 2 years. Would you agree with that, Jess? It takes a long time.
Yep, yep. And you'll do the therapy and then potentially maybe a few years down the road, you might need to go back and revisit it again just because sometimes the trauma can come back, but it's definitely not as hard the next time.
Every psychologist does it a little bit differently, but the psychologists that I know get you write down kind of like your 10 or 20 worst memories. So you kind of write down the worst things that have happened to you in your life, which sounds fucking horrible, and it is. And then basically they get you to relive through that memory while also doing like desensitization with you. And then from that, when you think of that memory, it doesn't hold the same emotional value. Is that what happened to you, Jess?
Yeah. It was like it went from me actually being in the moment and removing that over and over again to stepping back and seeing it from another point. Like, it was almost like I was watching a movie. I wasn't there anymore. I was back and I was like, oh yeah, I remember that happened and it still hurts, but it's not all controlling of my trauma anymore.
Yeah, I find EMDR can be really beneficial. There's a friend of mine, because I have a lot of ex-military friends. He was there with the Bali bombings and he recovered some bodies that were burned. And I've known him for a very, very long time, well over 15 years. And when I first met him, he just said he'd been through some trauma, could not talk to me, could not look me in the eye. And I would just change the subject. Like, what are you doing today? How are you, mate? And anyway, it was only probably 5 years in that he just dropped to me out of nowhere that he had recovered these bodies and how it felt for him. And I said to him, wow, fuck, that's a heavy story. Are you all right? And he was like talking to me like he just dropped off his groceries. And I actually thought, shit, he's disassociated. Like, that was what I thought initially, because it was such a heavy story that he said so, like, without really a lot of emotion. And he said to me he'd just done 2 years of EMDR and he said, I just feel like I can actually talk to people about things. And for him, sharing that really meant a lot for him and for me in the friendship. But I was really spun out when I saw how different he was throughout it. He actually replayed all of the memories via audio when he would go to sleep. And it just became like a familiar thing for him, that he just, the emotion went out of it for him. So yeah, anyway, I don't want to keep going about it, but I agree with you. I think EMDR is a great therapy. You just got to be aware of what it is. And if you ask for it, just know it can be a little tough, and I would not be scheduling it like, oh, I'm going to do it between 1 and 2 and then I'm going to pick up my kids. Like, there is some downtime needed in between life and an EMDR appointment.
I found I was exhausted after the session because you all get super emotional. Honest, definitely, it's worthwhile to do that hard work for the benefits after. Like, I'm totally off antidepressants, which
Are
is
you?
Amazing. Yeah.
Congrats. Wow. So what would be, let's just say an example, what would be a symptom or something that you would find from your trauma that you used to have that you don't have now that you've done EMDR?
The massive fight or flight. Like, I would get into a situation that reminded me of something that had occurred overseas, and my adrenaline would surge, or my heart would be racing. I would just have that full, I need to get out of here. I'm fully triggered, sweating, like my stomach would just, it was awful. Whereas now I can be in the same situation and I may get a little bit of anxiety, but I do my 5-4-3-2-1 and I'm good to go. Like, I'm definitely not how I used to be. And if I had Arch with me and I went like that and he was having a bad day, it would make me even worse. So it's, you know, 100% worth doing, especially if you have children, because they don't need to cop what's happened to you.
Yeah. And I suppose, and I mean, I haven't done this, so I don't want to make speculations. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine if you're reliving in that anyway, you may as well do EMDR in a therapy setting than to have that be throughout your life unknown with your kids there, instead of walking into an office and be like, I know that I'm going to have to do this. It's then going to stop that interruption, I would imagine.
Yep. Always, anyone that is having issues like that, always say to them, well, it's not going to be pleasant. It's going to be hard. But in 12 months' time, you're going to turn around and go, oh my God, it was unpleasant, it was hard, but I can function now. Like, I can live my life.
True. And, you know, there's a lot of telehealth places that are starting to do EMDR by telehealth. So if you do live remote, you're having trouble getting in, everyone has trouble getting into psychologists these days, you can do it over telehealth now, which I think is at least increased flexibility at least.
Well, that's awesome too, because there's a lot of people who are just, they can't leave their home. So to be able to have that therapy in your home, in your safe place, is amazing.
Yeah, especially if you've got to drive home. Like, if you have to drive quite a way, you do your EMDR and then you have to drive an hour home.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a car-related trauma. It's like, that's probably something that you don't need to have being there. Did you ever have any issues with nightmares? Like, has it helped you sleep?
Oh, yeah. I've never, ever been a good sleeper, even before I joined the army. But I get at least 5 hours now, whereas I was on nothing before. Like, I was barely existing.
Well, well done to you, Jess, for seeking help, but also for doing EMDR. It's not for the faint-hearted, and I'm sure it's really helping you move forward. You know, you're only young. You've got a very young son. So congrats, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Oh, yes. Well, my service in my podcast, but, you know, I don't think I contributed a lot in my short career in the RAF.
Everybody who signed that dotted line, Army, Navy, Air Force, we all contributed. I don't care what people say.
The toxic work environment, which we shouldn't get into this one. But I just feel like I was really squashed down and then just left there. I had to rebuild later when I got out. Like, oh, I think I'm actually okay. But I was told I was crap for a long time every day.
Oh, my God. The toxicity within the Defence Force is awful. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who don't understand the difference between discipline and non-discipline. Like, with military, when we're out in the field and we're in a section of attack, yes, you're going to get yelled at because your commander needs to keep you all safe. That is discipline. Whereas some people already yelled at me, you know, and it's like, how the hell did you get past sight to to be here if you can't handle that, because at the end of the day, it's his responsibility to keep you guys alive and to get to the objective and carry out the mission. You know, yeah, but the military attracts psychos.
Yeah, it does. I actually think it's similar to when I'm in a car park with my kids, I don't fuck around. I will yell at them to keep them safe. If I have to yell at them to get out of the way and they're walking in front of a car, I'll do it. Doesn't worry. Mm-hmm. It's like, and it comes from fear because you want to keep them safe.
That's right.
But you don't then say to them, what a fucking idiot. Why would you walk in front of the car? How dumb are you? I totally agree with you. There's yelling at somebody to keep them safe and to create discipline because it's needed. And then there's just attacking people personally, which doesn't need to be there. And I think maybe the commanders don't know the difference, because it doesn't seem to be any difference to me. It's like, oh, I'm yelling at you because that's my job. But it's like, yeah, but you probably could take out the personal insults, because I'm actually losing all confidence to ever do anything. And I'm just going to stand here like an idiot because I think I am one.
Yeah, there are good commanders, and I've been privileged to work under some very good commanders, but I've also had the unfortunate, I guess it's not a privilege, I've been unfortunately had to work under quite a few that should never, ever be in charge of soldiers.
Yeah, when you're all trapped together and you can't leave, a lot of people just, you know, like you just quit, right? Yeah. But you can't.
No.
Anyway, we should probably get onto that on another episode. But thank you so much for your time and your service, Jess. I really appreciate you sharing today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.